Hey everyone, welcome back to The Growth Signal, where we are rethinking customer relationships, how we build them, how we keep them, and how we continue to lead as customer expectations rapidly evolve. My name is Alyssa Nolte.
I'm Matt Bolinax.
And we are going to have a fantastic conversation today. So Matt, let's get right into it. What is your hot take?
My hot take is that while AI will be extremely beneficial and useful for early stage brands, it will create a massive issue on the retention side, as there will be no or few elements of personalization or traces of the human element behind the scenes actually building these brands.
Yeah, I think that's totally fair. ChatGPT-5 just came out and I was messing with it this morning as I was getting ready for the day. And I'm a small startup and I'm trying to build a brand, right? And every single thought leader in branding will tell you that, you know, the best brands are truly connected with the person who built them. They are human and they are thoughtful and you put all this thing into them. And yet it's so easy for me to go into ChatGPT and try to brainstorm my brand and my experience and what my customers are going to hear from me and feel from me. But in reality, that's just kind of like an amalgamation of every brand that's ever been. And if we're all doing that, we're not going to have any unique experiences anymore.
I think that's exactly right. And I think the ability to build a scalable brand off the back of AI in terms of writing quippy emails or funny text messages or riffing on website copy. Those are great use cases for AI. I think what gets lost in the sauce is as the world becomes increasingly more AI-able, there's inevitably going to be a pendulum swing back to everything feels AI-able and like what actually feels like a human. And I think the necessity for human interaction has been something that's existed since the dawn of time. And as we move away from that, I actually think there'll be a reverberation back towards the desire to have that. So the more you can humanize your brand while still leveraging the tactics of AI-based copywriting, thoughtful emails, et cetera, on use cases, but the more you can continue to highlight the folks behind the scenes building the brand, I think that will actually prove to be of immense value going forward for certain brands.
Yeah, like don't get me wrong, I love my ChatGPT. I love to run everything through it just to make sure that what I am intending to say is translating, right? But usually I'm using my solution as my favorite prompt is roast this, because I want to have like let the robot make fun of me before the actual general public does. And like see the critical thinking side of what I'm saying, and is my message landing the way I intended. My concern, or maybe it's not even a concern, maybe it's my prediction, is that like the human element and the human experience is going to become something that is seen as a premium or a luxury thing that is only available to the brands that can afford it and the customers who can pay for that like level of human interaction, which is actually kind of scary if you think about it, because you're right. We've built entire civilizations off the need for human interaction.
Exactly right. And I think even predating AI, there were still abilities to leverage macros for email follow-ups, right? Like there were early traces of that that brands would certainly lean into, which again, I think from a strategy versus tactics perspective, the tactical side of incorporating AI into your day-to-day workflow is actually a really powerful thing. We do that daily at Huron. But I do think there are elements of personalized outreach where we are still penning the emails. We hop on calls with our customers quite regularly to understand, why are you a subscriber? Like, what brought you to Huron? Like, anything going wrong with Huron? Like, why haven't you bought this product? All those learnings in a very one-to-one interaction like this have been very valuable for us. Now, who's to say in 9 months this doesn't exist and like I'm actually an avatar that looks like me and then I don't have to do these? Who knows? With the customer calls. But until then, I do think that is truly a point of difference when you think about the concept of winning on the margin. And for us, winning is to not go to the grocery store and pick up brand X or not ordering brand Y, but it's like, hey, like I buy from here on and that guy called me and I did a survey with him like 2 years ago and that was really cool. So like, yeah, I'm going to rebuy that product. I think that's where you start to see the snowball effect of some of these true one-to-one engagements that are very difficult to apply some sort of marketing metric. There is no ROI. There is no ROAS measurement. There is no 7-day click. But like, how do you think about truly like investing in that relationship element to create this type of bond that you can then, you know, basically expect that person to be not necessarily a lifetime customer, but damn near close to it.
So tell us a little bit more about your business, because a lot of the people that come on the podcast tend to fit into the more business to business sales side of the house. So we'd love to hear a different perspective as someone who's primarily selling to individual people.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So we're a men's personal care brand. We launched about 6 years ago. Our two main channels are our own website, useyouron.com, and then Amazon. So we have a pretty substantial Amazon business as well. We recently launched into HEB, which is a pretty big Texas-based retailer. That was a big win for us. That's a tremendous retailer. They have a ton of pull in Texas. And it's really hard to describe how much someone can love a retailer until you go to an HEB and then it kind of clicks. But they've been a terrific partner for us. So the world of wholesale is kind of new for us in that regards, but we've been, a D2C e-commerce business now for a little over 6 years. So we make everything from body wash, shampoo, face wash, cologne, and the kind of the shtick behind the business, the little elevator pitch. Prior to starting Huron, I worked as an investor looking at a lot of traditional beauty and cosmetics businesses and was just in awe of the amazing leaders of those companies. And I found myself with a lot of friction between my 9 to 5 and 5 to 9. I was looking at companies like Drunk Elephant every day and being like, wow, this is such a cool brand. And then I'd get off work and go buy Mountain Rush body wash at CVS, right? I'm like,
You mean Irish Spring and Old Spice aren't good enough for you?
We won't name names. But yeah, it was the same old products repackaged into 87 different scent types. And I was like, wow, this is kind of interesting. So that was always like a professional outlet that was of interest to me. And secondly, I was just a kid that grew up with bad skin. So look for products for a long time. Nothing really seemed to resonate. Finally found something that worked well and it was, you know, exorbitantly priced. So the thought was kind of how do you marry these two worlds of expensive products and then a customer that probably wants to use something better than Mountain Blast body wash, but really doesn't know where to start. So we kind of started up early stages in 2018, launched 29 and 2019, and 6 years later, here we are.
That's super cool. And tell us about your customers. Who are the people that, you know, are looking for your types of products? And how did you come to the conclusion that you had the right ideal customer profile?
Great question. Last one first. I have been entrepreneurially minded for a really long time, but I wouldn't consider myself like an entrepreneur, as weird as that sounds. Why this is really exciting for me in this journey is I am our own customer. And I think that makes things really, really, I won't say easy, but I feel this intimate end connection with whom we're targeting and whom we're building products for. And it just makes it a lot more streamlined and at times a bit easier to just understand, like, you know, when it's Tuesday in January in New York City and it's pitch black, it makes it a little bit more enjoyable to get out of bed every morning because we know who we're fighting for. But that's an aside. In terms of kind of target customer profiles, we really have four personas. One is the performance-minded person. So someone who is probably more active, is very conscious of what they're putting in their body in terms of health, and what they eat on the day-to-day, if they take any supplements, et cetera. But the thought of what they put on their body is kind of like, doesn't even enter the chat. So like, can we infuse intentionality into that equation? Second is young dads. So the concept of like, hey, I have 48 seconds over the course of the day to like actually push reset. Can you actually enjoy those 48 seconds? And like, we be the brand, you know, we're an aspiring brand to kind of fill that void there. Third is her for him. So she is oftentimes the buyer for the household in this category, upwards of like 85%+. So the ability to create a brand that resonates with a much more educated customer in this space in terms of ingredient profile. So all of our formulas are 100% vegan, certified cruelty-free, free of phthalates, parabens, sulfates, silicones, like a lot of the no-nos that are very common in a Sephora or Ulta, but like for a lot of guys might be like, I have no idea what those are. So the ability to kind of talk about product and ingredient quality. And fourth is what we'll call graduating life. So kind of major milestones in a guy's life. So think about graduating college, potentially moving in with a partner, getting married, having kids. So at those moments, which I've gone through all four, there's kind of like this irrational consumer behavior of like, what I have now is not good enough. Like, hey, I'm just graduating college. Like, none of these work shirts are going to cut it. I need new work shirts. Or you move in, it's like, none of these t-shirts fit anymore. I'm going to go buy 5 Vuori t-shirts. So there's just like this almost customer irrationality of pushing reset. And again, can we be that brand that has the same product quality of stuff you'd find for 4 to 5x the price, but is only a few bucks more than what you're currently spending? So those are kind of the four distinct customer personas that we've identified and have gone after.
I think all of those are really smart. And it's funny that like some of the ones that you are mentioning, most of my work has been in customer behavior research, right? And we had a particularly strong foothold in financial research, like how do people decide what bank to go to and all of those decisions that happen. And a lot of the things that you're talking about in your persona groups are very similar, right? People really only change their banks when they have a life stage change is what we called it, right? They bought a car, they bought a house, they got married, they moved, right? They went to college, those kinds of things. But otherwise, we're not really thinking about changing our banks and going to a new bank. There is a lot of her for him. It's just a little bit different in that one person in the relationship is making that decision. So you're trying to figure out how do you target that financial decision maker. I loved that you said specifically the her for him as well, because that's definitely how it works in my household, right? My husband doesn't want to use the Korean snail mucin serum that I have because he's weirded out by it. And he would rather use something different. So instead, we're trying to figure out like what is a good quality product that's going to get him the results that he wants, that pays attention to his skin type and what he needs without wrapping it in a pretty little pink box that he's going to be too embarrassed to take with him on his business trip.
Bingo.
So when you got started on this, I wouldn't say that like men's skincare is a vertical that I think of very often, right? I can go into Sephora or Ulta and I can see about 75,000 different brands for women. So did you have any pressure or pushback from people who said, you know, men don't really care about this, so why are you even bothering to get their attention?
All the time. And I thought it was kind of a funny, you know, oftentimes from the investor community, quite frankly, as a reason for passing on Huron, of which I know who all those people are. But this notion of, well, guys just don't care. Well, it's like, well, sure they do. It's just not something that has been marketed to, packaged in a certain way that simply resonated, right? And I do think there has been an evolution of the way guys take care of themselves over time, for sure. Remember when I was in high school, like it was cool not to care, right? You were like, oh, I've worn this shirt for 3 days in a row. It's like, well, that's gross. Whatever works well for you.
I have a 10-year-old and it's still that way. I have to remind him that it's cool to shower and do your laundry.
Weird, right?
I also think it must be an evolutionary thing because it seems to transcend generation and time.
Sure, fair enough. I also think there's a lot of instances where guys truly are premium consumers or customers, the delta being buyer versus user, but they don't realize it, right? You know, maybe a guy grabs his three buddies and they go on a fishing trip and they throw all their beers in a Yeti cooler. That's a $600 cooler. You can buy an Igloo cooler for like $30, but they don't, right? And it's why. It's because Yeti speaks about quality and lifetime guarantee, and there's a commitment to the craftsmanship and a lot of those things that resonate. Well, you just bought something that is 10x of what else exists on the market. So why can't that exist elsewhere, right? If you think about like the boot market. You know, there's so many other examples of like elements of craftsmanship and artisanry to say, hey, like this product is just like fundamentally a better made product, better inputs, and therefore you should expect better outputs. But I don't think that way of positioning, you know, maybe more of a broader context, men's grooming has really ever been communicated. And I think that's something we're excited to bring to the table.
Yeah, there's definitely an education happening that I see just in my own community here in small town Iowa, where people are starting to think about like, oh, I can have clean and clear skin. I can look younger. I can, you know, smell good and look good. And that's a good thing to do. Part of that's probably, I think part of that's like the social media coming through and people are seeing that it's possible to look younger, even though you are, you know, in your late 40s or whatever your age is. As you're working with your customers, because there is a little bit of like an education component to to your product and particularly in the market that you're in. So how do you educate customers about the benefits that you bring to the table and why you're better and different without boring them?
Good question. In harkening back to our original premise, like this is a great use case for AI, right? Which is just like, hey, how do you take, you know, the concept of a super hydrating and moisturizing body wash because it has shea butter and a number of other vitamins and minerals and say, okay, now give me like a 5-word tagline that would resonate with the guy who's buying Yeti clothes, right? And one of the things we learned originally as like pushback or reasons for a negative customer review was that the body wash was slimy. So this feels slimy on my skin. It's like actually, but then we would get the other side, which is positive reviews, which would be this body wash is so hydrating, I don't have to use body lotion anymore once I get out of the shower. So there was this notion of like the mass market products that have existed since seemingly the beginning of time are so stripping of your skin's natural oils that like you'd be like, oh my God, like where is the body lotion that I need to like put on after the shower? We've completely like rewritten that rule. So it's like, again, what was perceived as like, oh, this is weird because it's like, no, actually this is just what happened. Like instead of stripping your skin of all its essentials, we're just adding to.
Right.
And once we started to communicate that, that became like a really interesting value prop that people really resonated with. So that's just like one of like 50 different examples, but truly trying to like take the position of an older brother type figure to say like, hey, we don't know everything, but like we know a little bit more because we're like, we've been around the block just a little bit longer. And here's what we've learned along the way. So again, trying to like take science, push it through some sort of communication device and say, how can we talk about this in a way similar to as if we were having like beers and wings at B2B3s watching like Monday Night. And like, that's how we want the tone of voice and the articulation of the why to be versus some like hoity-toity, well, like, this is what the coastal elites have to say about face wash. Like that's not the jam that we're looking for.
So if someone is listening to this and they are a startup or a solopreneur or a small business, and they are trying to figure out how to get that brand voice of, you know, like you said, the older brother kind of experience. How can they, like, what's the first thing you would have them start doing in order to start to develop that and avoid the trap of becoming just an AI generic produced brand? What should they do first?
Yeah. Really great question. I think first is establishing the framework of what is the voice that needs to be adjusted. Right. But like, what are those unique selling props? Because what I would even argue is more important than what is the tone of voice or what is the persona who is ultimately speaking these words is what are the unique selling points of your brand? Right. For instance, one of our unique value props that people really gravitate towards, and it kind of speaks to the craftsmanship aspect, is my co-founder used to run product development for Estee Lauder, and he built the first 7 fragrances for Tom Ford. Right. So when we think about true points of difference, there are very few brands in our category, if any, and none on the men's side, that have that level of product expertise that sit in-house.
Yeah.
And I think that truly is the point of difference. So from there, it's like, okay, like this is a unique selling prop. How do you communicate it in a way that would resonate with the end consumer? We know for all of our personas, the concept of value is really, really important, right? Like you can sell high priced goods, but the customer and the consumer have to appreciate the value that comes alongside of them. So we can say things like built by the same folks as Tom Ford, but a quarter of the price. So you can address the fact that there is a craftsmanship element, an understanding of how fine products are built, but also showing value that you can get that, but at this price. So again,
and it's going to be more expensive than Mountain Blast from your local corner grocery store, but it's not going to be like the luxury price of a Tom Ford.
Correct. And I think the reason for us saying this is not Mountain Blast, it's more expensive, but we have the same guy as Tom Ford, and taking the other approach is where you set that anchor, right? And we're anchoring against a Tom Ford because that's the level of quality we want people to associate Huron with, not marginally more better than what you could get at.
We're slightly better than that random generic store brand that you have been buying and is stripping your skin. Yeah.
There you go. Bingo.
So it can't have all been this easy though, right? Like you're talking about having really four well-defined personas, a good understanding of your market. And you do, I do agree, have a leg up because you are your customer in this case. But like, tell us, how did it get here? Like what, were there times where you were like, you know what? I can't do this. I'm done. I'm out.
Admittedly, never that, because I think part of the founder journey is this notion of irrational optimism.
You have to have that if you're going to start a company.
Have to. Like the moment that an inkling of doubt enters your mind, done. Like the business is done. So there's, now you can have various degrees of irrational optimism. But I do think there is this notion of you start out to create businesses, or we start out to create Huron, because unequivocally there was a massive opportunity in the market, and that opportunity has not gone away. So long as there's that light peeping under the door, we will continue to sprint at that. Now there are certainly, and everyone will experience these, challenges along the way, right? Like no one could predict a global pandemic. Interest rate hikes, like consumer sentiment. These are things that banking failures, when SVB collapsed, like five of my friends' startups just evaporated. Like that's probably the least likely thing that you'd expect that would kill your startup is the fact that your bank collapsed, right?
Right.
So what you do is you try and just control what you can, and you can't really let a lot of these macro factors enter the chat because you'll drive yourself crazy. So one of the things that we committed to really early on, and admittedly led to the fact that we were not an explosive grower out of the gates. We grew really well out of the gates. We were not an explosive darlings of all of these media publications, is we just really understood our numbers. And we said, like, for us to make this P&L work, we have to operate within this very narrow band on the marketing side of things. And if things don't work at that level, then we're not going to spend. So it took a while for us to accumulate enough learnings to say, hey, this subset of people like have really come back and continue to buy these subsorts of products. Like, let's talk to them. Like, and then you ask questions. You wake up on 8 a.m. on a Saturday morning. What do you do for the next 3 hours? Oh, you know, I like to go on a long walk with my dog and my wife. Like I go out for a long bike ride. I'm like, okay, like performance mentality. Like that's really interesting. Yeah. So you start to collect all these data points, and as much as you want to project your brand identity to the world, your customers are oftentimes steering that ship. So it's truly understanding like what is working with your best customers or folks who are showing signs of being really strong customers, truly understanding like what are the similarities between those folks, mapping those out and kind of developing these personas, and then going trying to find more of those people. And that's a process that's taken us years, quite frankly, to execute. Because we're revisiting, we're being like, you know, are these the right four? Are these the right five? We're constantly stress testing that. But where we really started to create a lot of upside, namely in the past like 12 to 18 months, is truly starting to double down and be like, we've stress tested these a ton. And it's these four that keep coming back.
Mm-hmm.
So now let's go sprint at them.
Yeah, having that really aligned product market fit and understanding exactly who buys is really the difference between a startup that explodes and a startup that never gets off the ground. So you and I got to meet because a podcast guest, Eli Weiss, made the introduction. So now it is your turn. Yeah, he put you in the hot seat. Now it is your turn. We want to hear from you. Who do you think is leading the charge? Who is changing the way we think about business or finding relationships with our customers?
Our two brothers who are in New York City, who are in a brand called Minted New York, Sean and Marcus Milioni. They do not adhere to any of the general rules of business. They make supplements. They make jewelry. They make menswear. They make running shoes. Like, it is...
You mean they didn't niche down like everyone tells you to?
No, they vibe create, which is awesome. But they do what they want to do, which is fantastic. But they pour their heart and soul into everything. And the quality on everything is like a 14 out of 10. They have both built their brands based off of their own social presences. So strong YouTube audience on Marcus's side, strong TikTok side. And they truly develop in public. They'll get samples back from a jacket. What do you guys think about this? And it's really a refreshing way to see how a business can be built. But I think without knowing like the guts and being in the weeds of day-to-day, you know, founder life, it's really difficult to execute in so many categories from which they do, which is like really, really impressive. So anyways, I think either one of those guys would be terrific guests just to share like the power of distribution as a content angle and how they think about truly building their brand for the long term, knowing that they're truly bringing their audience alongside for each and every pivotal moment along the way.
Truly true customer centricity, not just pretending at it. That's really cool.
Bingo.
And if someone is really connecting with you and they want to learn more, where can they find you online?
Twitter is probably the easiest place. Just Matt Mullinex. I like Twitter. It's fun. It's like if you have 10 minutes in between tasks, that's like my fun sandbox where I go and just read. But it's a great community. Yeah, that's probably the easiest place.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining me on The Growth Signal.
Thank you, Alyssa. Appreciate it.